Our neuro-linguistic portions of the brain, combined with our associative capacities, our acute eyesight, our tactile sensitivity, and fine motor control, all of which are reflected on the neural level by complex systems of organization that govern all these functions, these essentially give us the neural hardware, the wetware, if you will, that is needed to run the software of cultural programs, right? The symbolic capacity. So, really sticking my neck out here, I want to suggest that perhaps one explanation for this is that some of these psychotropic allelochemicals, specifically some of these hallucinogens, which were probably widespread in the environment that these primates evolved in the forms of mushrooms like Psilocybe cubensis, may have directly or indirectly affected the evolutionary development of human neurolinguistic adaptations. Our large size and complex neural organization of the brain is directly related to our linguistic and symbolic abilities. The neurons that control the lips, the tongue, the facial muscles involved in speech are disproportionately hypertrophied in the human brain. The brain also has large specialized internal structures devoted to language and understanding and processing language. Well, if you think about what language is, and it's really language that distinguishes, I mean, language is that, you know, both written and spoken is the vehicle that on which we erect these symbolic structures. A fundamental characteristic of linguistic and symbolic systems is the intimate association of sounds and images. Language is literally imagination in the truest sense. Have an agreed upon meaning. I can say table and you think of a table, or you visualize a table in your head. So you have certain, I make certain sounds and that triggers certain pictures in your imagination. That's why you can understand me. Reading written words is another extension of this. My eyes see the words, I can hear the words in my imagination, and that interior speech evokes the same pictures that speech evokes if heard. Well, it seems to me that what underlies this process of linguistic understanding, that what mediates this symbolic process, is in a way a process of synesthesia. Synesthesia is experiencing one sensory modality in terms of another. It's like you can see sounds or hear colors. Well, hallucinogens are one of the few chemicals, one of the few drugs we know of that can reliably induce a process of synesthesia. It's very commonly experienced under the influence of hallucinogens. It's one of the few instances, except that we routinely engage in this process of language, which is a synesthetic process, but we don't think about it very much. But then when we take a hallucinogen and experience synesthesia, it seems remarkable. We say, well, I heard I saw the sounds, or I heard the colors, or whatever, and this seems remarkable to us. But there may have been a time in human evolution when this association between the spoken word or meaningless sounds and meaningful images was not so obvious. And could it have been a synesthesia induced by a plant hallucinogen which provided this triggering event that led to the realization of the equivalence of sound and image, and hence gave rise to the first human language? This is clearly speculation, but this is one possibility where these plant hallucinogens may have played a role in human evolution and into the evolution of the language and symbol using species that we are. Obviously, it's hard to check this. I mean, nobody can prove me wrong, but I can't prove myself right either. So at that point, I think we have to leave it there. This is a painting by Pablo Angarico, the Peruvian painter, that shows in his paintings, he represents synesthesia. Synesthesia is a common experience under the influence of ayahuasca, and he represents it by these wavy lines that surround everything. This is how he shows synesthesia in his paintings. So,
That's
quite enough, I think, and that's all I was going to say. So, sorry. So long-winded. Do you have any questions? Good.
I guess probably everybody has, or maybe not, but everybody has heard of some evolutionary example that seems to not quite fit into what we normally think of evolution. I like the example of the hammer orchid and the wasp, which is required to pollinate it. The hammer orchid smells like the female wasp. The male wasps are hatched out or a week earlier than the female wasps, and the hammer orchid flowers at the same time that the male wasps are coming out. So there's lots of male wasps around and no female wasps, so they all happily pollinate the hammer orchids.
Mm-hmm.
And the evolutionary idea that there was a trial and error narrowing in on this particular scent, such that now we got it, now it works. But in that case, a miss is as good as a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like many of the examples here also, it doesn't seem like you would hunt around in this absolute myriad molecules, universe of molecules, by trial and error and find out the right one.
So in other words, how could it have taken place through random selection?
Yeah.
Right.
You can postulate all kinds of things like non-local mind and what have you.
Right, right. Or morphogenetic fields or whatever. I mean, it's hard to rationalize some of this. I think it's clear that, natural selection is one of the processes that operates in evolution, but clearly not the only process. I think they're now beginning to realize, well, we were speaking, the artificial life specialist says, there are other boundary conditions on this process that put constraint on natural selection. That's only one of the things. There are other determinants that which are not fully understood yet, which I think must explain why these things seem sometimes more directed. It's not exactly design, but there's more to it than just random throwing up of molecular templates and selecting out the one which seems to fit it. I don't know. I mean, yeah, you might have. Yeah.
Have you talked with Lynn Margulis at all about the notion of external chemical agents becoming incorporated into multicellular organisms later on and now being adapted?
Now being adapted to internal functions? I have not talked with her about it, but I think it's a notion she would be sympathetic to.
Yeah, it's scaled down from single cell organisms
getting incorporated into each other. Right. And there's been interesting work, there's been work looking at different receptors. Certain bacteria, for example, have endorphin receptors on the surface of their outside. Well, what does endorphins do for bacteria? Who knows? But it's not what they, that was probably the original function of endorphins. And then we, or complex organisms, they became adapted to internal functions. And it's true for just about all our neurotransmitters. I mean, you can find these things in microorganisms as well. So, yeah.
Now, we were looking at the synaptic cleft and the something like serotonin being released and then getting a receptor site.
Mm-hmm.
It must take a certain amount of transit time and a certain amount of time back to get causing a certain amount of cyclic time. These psychoactive hallucinogenic drugs, do they have a different transit time, and is this what causes the slight variation that turns into hallucinogenic states? Or
what really happens in the cleft? You asked the $64,000 question.
Variations within
It may be variations in transit time. It may be the, I mean, another factor is that the exogenously introduced hallucinogen tends to, you know, essentially massively flood the system with an excess of these chemicals, whereas internally they're released in small amounts in specific places in specific times. I mean, it may be that, you know, it's more when they're exogenously introduced and all your receptors are flooded immediately with something like dimethyltryptamine, for example, you get the acute, you know, overwhelming hallucinogenic response. Well, dimethyltryptamine is in the brain, you know, itself, but it may never, it may only be released in small amounts under certain, you know, at certain specific sites. So you never get an internal effect like a DMT flash, because it doesn't work that way.
It's probably also a problem of permeability.
It's also a problem.
Because that brain barrier is always in between you and...
That's right. But many of these things readily cross the blood. And yeah, I mean, transit time is one of the things. The other thing is maybe they don't, you know, maybe they fit into the receptor in a different way, and, you know, they don't evoke quite the same type of response. I mean, I don't think it's well understood why they're different, you know. Yeah.
Sometimes you have artists, drummers, I'm thinking of particularly, who report synesthesia as a result of artistic activities.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think that there is an endogenous mechanism.
There is an endogenous mechanism, definitely. In fact, your comment, I recently remember seeing an article about a woman, a doctor in England, who was studying a person who, what was it? She was able to reliably see colors, or rather see sounds, that he could give certain tones, and she had a genetic... It was two sisters. That was the thing that was interesting. They both had this ability. They weren't identical twins, but I believe they were twins. And they, you know, they both had very specific synesthetic responses to certain tones. But they weren't the same, right? Person A saw blue at the key of C, and the other one saw yellow or something. But they could both consistently see it. So they're beginning to find out there is definitely an internal mechanism for synesthesia, at least in some people. And, you know, as I say, when we engage in a symbolic activity, we do it routinely. I mean, we don't even think about it, but that's really what's happening. So, yeah. Not that I'm aware of. Yeah.
Dennis, I think I asked you about this a little bit before, but it's clear that some psychoactive chemicals are actually defensive chemicals. They're there to slow down, stop the spurge, herbivores, for instance. Mescaline is found in a spineless cactus. A lot of San Pedro has relatively loose spines compared to other cactus. It looks like the plant's investing in defensive chemicals rather than spine. Maybe LSD and morning glory seeds is there to slow down mice. So what puzzles me is that since DMT is so widespread in the plant world, and maybe it's serving these other functions that you mentioned in the plant world, why don't plants more often just mix in some beta carbolines and have an excellent defensive chemical?
As a defensive chemical, in addition?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't know. The short answer is I don't know, right? They do. They're very close biosynthetically, and you often get plants that have both. But usually, like one or the other usually predominates. Like in Varroa, for example, you get primarily tryptamines and only traces of beta-carbolines. In certain malpighiaceous plants, such as Banisteriopsis argentea, or now a different species, I understand, but... You know, you get primarily, yeah, which one is it?
Muricata.
That's right. You get primarily beta-carbolines, but only and also traces of DMT. Why it doesn't happen more often, I don't know. It may be that what these tryptamines generally, the function they generally subserve in the plant is more of a plant growth inhibitor than being targeted at herbivores. And in that case, you know, there's no need for the MAO inhibitor. If they're biosynthesized as a defense against herbivores, then you're right. It would make sense to have beta-carbolines to render them orally active.
Also, it's possible that it's just in the case of the herbivores, it could simply be the bitterness that's involved.
It's also
as
right.
a defensive function, not the psychoactivity.
Right, right.
Although we tend to see it in terms of.
But
that.
We can, you know, again, that sets us apart in terms of our behavior, and we can perceive a chemical quality of a plant, such as bitterness, which would drive, you know, any sensible herbivore away. It wouldn't want to eat it. We say, oh great, it's bitter, you know, it must make a good drug, so, you know, then we
it's known
go
for
it even more.
It's known, for example, in the case of secondary compounds in nectars, that different classes of animals that are pollinating species, principally you have birds, bats, which are mammals, and then insects, react differently to different categories of secondary compounds. And mammals seem to be, bats are deterred by alkaloids in nectars, but bees aren't. And so it's another subtle interaction.
Right. Again, probably because to bees, they probably aren't bitter. I mean, they probably have a whole different set of receptors and probably perceive these things differently. This is the result of this biochemical coevolution, the evolution of these receptors, and how the animals that interact with the plants perceive these chemical qualities.
Do some of the simple flora organisms like nematodes also have MAO, or the DMT affect them more strongly?
They certainly have MAO. You mean, would DMT be orally active, for instance, in them?
Some of the similar cellular organisms. A lot of times it's not a food bar, so it makes me wonder.
Right.
It's
very possible. One speculation, for instance, psilocybin is, you know, a serotonin, affects the serotonin system. Snails and those sorts of things love to feast on mushrooms. So perhaps what psilocybin really is a snail poison, a snail defense. I mean, it certainly is, you know, might protect the mushroom from being consumed by snails in that respect. But then, you know, since it's valuable to us, or since we're interested in it, affects that whole relationship as well. So I don't know. I mean, it's speculation, a lot of this, but good enough. Thanks for bearing with me. Sorry.